This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. We're 103 days away from the November election, but are we ready? States without mail-in voting have been trying to play catch-up. Others say they're keeping in person, but in polling places that allow for distance, like empty arenas. The primaries have already involved hours-long lines and voting machine meltdowns. Well, we see the same in November. Joining us to talk about it is Alabama's Secretary of State, John Merrill. Secretary Merrill, welcome to 1A.
Hello, Jen. Great to be with you.
Also with us from Austin, Texas, is Jessica Hoosman. She covers voting rights and elections for ProPublica. Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Secretary Merrill, what are the biggest challenges when it comes to planning an election during a pandemic?
Well, the challenges are no different than the challenges that you normally face whenever you're preparing for the administration of election, and that is to make sure that you're people at the county level, all 67 counties in the state of Alabama, are the probate judges who are responsible for the administration of the election, that they're fully prepared, fully educated and oriented as to whatever changes may be taking place, and that they have taken time to ensure that their local people who are in each one of the 1,980 polling sites in the state of Alabama are fully prepared to execute the election without any compromise whatsoever.
So what have you been doing to prepare for the November elections?
Well, we began our planning for the November elections several months ago, even before 2020 began, because we have a primary that took place on March the 3rd. Our runoff, which was scheduled for March the 31st, was postponed until last week on July the 14th. And then we would continue with the certification of the elections and all those things that are so necessary. But then we move right on into the orientation for the planning of and the execution of the November 3rd general election. So with the changes that have occurred locally, statewide and nationally because of the coronavirus, it's very important for us to make sure that any anxiety that might have been created or that might exist among our people is alleviated to the extent possible, and to make sure that they have a greater understanding of what they need to do in order to carry out the election and to make sure that nothing happens that could cause a problem for any voter or anyone that would have a question about the authenticity of the election.
So you were sued by several organizations that argued you should have relaxed the photo ID and witness requirements due to the hardships presented because of the pandemic. Why did you decide to keep those requirements?
Well, there's a thing in Alabama that we follow to the letter, and it's called the law. So we're going to make sure that we do everything according to the standards that have been set aside by the people of Alabama through the Alabama legislature and enacted by the governor's signature in what is now in the code or the constitution of the state of Alabama. So relaxing the requirements that we have relaxed, we were able to do so because the code and the constitution allow us to do so. The other things that other people have encouraged us to do, desired us to do, want us to do, are not permissible by law. Some of those things involve curbside voting. Some of them require removing the witness requirements. Those things are not allowed according to state law. So we're not going to break the law.
I want to make this note. The Alabama Disabilities Advocacy Program released a statement on Monday that says, in part, with the continued rise of COVID-19 cases in Alabama, we are relieved that the vast majority of voters will have the opportunity to vote by absentee ballot. However, we remain concerned for those with disabilities who will have significantly more difficulty meeting the witness and photo requirements that the state continues to require. We look forward to addressing these issues in trial. Jessica, I want to come to you here because you've been covering elections, and I think these are big questions for lots of states who are trying to figure out how to manage absentee and mail-in voting. What do you make of this conflict?
The conflict between the law and the need to vote by absentee, or what conflict are you addressing
between the law and the photo ID requirements?
Oh, yes. So, you know, I think that a lot of that states are handling this as best they can. I think that a lot of anger has been directed at election administrators who have very little authority to make these calls, you know, and instead that power lies with the governor or the state legislature. But I think that, you know, states have done a bit of a balancing act, and the states that have struggled with this have found themselves in court over this very same question. And most states are handling it just the way that Secretary Merrill has described, which is that you balance your ability to change the procedures on the ground with the needs of the people. And sometimes those two things are going to conflict because we're in unprecedented times.
Now, not every state does absentee or mail-in voting in the same way, Jessica. What does this look like in other states?
Sure. You know, I mean, I think it really depends on the states. Of course, we have five states where vote by mail is essentially universal. That will become six in November because California has decided to go all mail-in as well. We've also seen states do, you know, the success by which states have moved to mail-in ballots has really depended on how much experience they have doing mail-in ballots already and how much time they had to prepare. So, you know, Wisconsin has a built-in no-excuse absentee provision already. So in theory, that state could have transitioned very nicely over to expanded vote by mail because anyone in the state can vote by mail for any reason. But unfortunately, the state just didn't have much lead time. And so what we saw was sort of bickering until the final moments, leading thousands of people to have to vote in person. On the flip side, Kentucky has no such provision. And they had to essentially get emergency legislation passed so that they could transition to vote by mail for their primary and expand that as much as they could. And I think that what we saw in Kentucky was a success story, largely because Kentucky had a bit more time to prepare. They pushed their primary back, expanded mail-in voting pretty drastically, and was able to educate the public on how to appropriately vote, even in the middle of the pandemic, just by virtue of the time that they had available to them. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that's really starting to concern me about November is that we're sort of moving closer to it every day. And there are a lot of states that don't really seem to be preparing in the way that they need to.
Secretary Merrill, what differences are you expecting to see in absentee ballot requests for this year compared to 2016?
Well, one of the things that your listeners should know, Jen, is that when we expanded the absentee option by just encouraging people to check a particular box and then follow the rest of the laws as they have been passed related to absentees, we had a significantly higher set of participation standards than we had before. We had 43,693 absentee ballots requested for the runoff and 32,563 absentee ballots were returned. That set a state record for a runoff in the history of Alabama. I expect that we may have north of 100,000 absentee ballots requested when the November 3rd deadline arrives. And of course, there will be a deadline for absentee ballot requests prior to that day. That will be on October the 29th.
Well, we got this email from Nomi in Lafayette who writes, "The gentleman from Alabama said their preparations during this coronavirus are the same as they would be any year. How is that possible? Are they truly not going to do anything to protect the health of their voters? Better cleaning, more distance, mask requirements?" Well, we'll get into that after the break. For people who can't vote by mail, what will in-person polling places look like come November? We're speaking with ProPublica's Jessica Huseman and Alabama Secretary of State, Republican John Merrill. Secretary Merrill joins us as part of our Across America partnership with WBHM in Birmingham, where we make time to hear from communities around the country about how the pandemic is affecting their lives. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week, or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
I'm Jen White, and today we're discussing the November election. We asked you if you thought we were ready, and many of you were not optimistic.
I really don't have much concerns about voting in November. I'm planning on doing by mail anyway, but I don't think at least 3/4 of the country is ready for it. Maybe possibly even more. They're not ready. They've been thinking about the possibilities involved.
I personally feel that I am not prepared to wait for a week or more to see the results of this election, and I really do think that that goes for both sides. So I guess we'll see how many people just have an absolute breakdown that week.
Thank you, Joe and Tiffany, for sharing your thoughts. Still with us to make sense of all of this are Alabama Secretary of State Republican John Merrill and ProPublica's elections reporter Jessica Hoosman. Jessica, with the massive increase in mail-in voting this November, when will we actually know who won?
I think that that is an open question. I think that we do need to start normalizing for folks that we probably will not know who won on election night like we usually do. You know, these ballots just take so much longer to process and to count, and that doesn't mean that anything is wrong. It's just sort of the way that this system works versus the way that the systems we've used previously works. So I think that we should start getting comfortable knowing that we're going to have to wait 1 or 2 days, maybe 3, maybe a week. It really depends on how much the landscape changes before November.
Well, Secretary Merrill, people are keeping a close eye on Alabama. It has a high-stakes Senate election this year. Democratic Senator Doug Jones fighting to keep his seat from Republican Tommy Tuberville. Do you expect a delay in reporting from Alabama, considering how many mail-in ballots you're getting requests for?
Jen, there will be no delay in reporting in the state of Alabama on November the 3rd. Now, I do think it's important to remember this. I think it's important to remember that the certification of any election takes place a week after the election is over. People are so used to getting instant results on election day and looking at that and believing that those are the official returns, and they're not. Those are unofficial returns, and unofficial returns will be in as they normally are. And we will have all of our polling sites reporting fully on election day. All 1,980 polling sites will report on November the 3rd. Our election will end unofficially on November the 3rd. We will not be receiving ballots that we're not supposed to receive after November the 3rd. The only ones that we will be receiving after November the 3rd are the provisional ballots that need to be reviewed. That's standard by law. UOCAVA ballots that come in after the election, which are allowed to because those uniformed overseas and military voters, those are able to come in after Election Day. All the other election results will be in on Election Day, and we will begin to close the books on Election Day. So in Alabama, it's not going to be 2 or 3 days later, a week later, 2 weeks later. There's not going to be any of that in our state.
Well, we heard from Richard, who tweeted, as a black man from Alabama who stays in Birmingham, I'm prepared for super long lines and limited polling places to suppress our vote. With that being said, I'm definitely taking part in the mailing option, even though I don't trust that either. And then I want to circle back to the message we got from Nomi, who asked about preparations for in-person voting. How will your in-person polling places look in November?
Well, first of all, he would be in error to assume that he's going to have to wait in long lines, because one of the things that we've already done in Jefferson County, and all 67 counties will have this in place on Election Day, but Jefferson County has had it in place since 2016, is the electronic poll book. When people go to vote, their wait will be reduced 60 to 75% as far as time is concerned. And the reason for that is because instead of manually having to check people in through flipping through the pages and marking their names off with a yellow highlighter after they sign in, those things will be done electronically, which also reduces the possibility for errors to occur. We're excited about that. We will have those electronic poll books in all 67 counties, all 1,980 polling sites.
And in terms of safety around the pandemic, because I know we only have you for a couple more minutes, are you providing hand sanitizers? Will masks be required?
Let me just go ahead and say this. All poll workers will have masks. They'll have face masks. They'll have non-latex gloves. There'll be hand sanitizer for the voters as well as for the poll workers. We also will have sanitized wipes available, disinfectant spray that'll be used throughout the day. Voters that come to the polls that would like to have a mask that will not be wearing one, we have a state-issued mandate to wear a mask now. But if they don't have one, one will be provided. So all those accommodations are going to be made. Many polling places have already had the six-foot mark placed in between for social distancing purposes, as well as at the tables where people will be able to vote in secrecy.
One last question, Secretary Merrill. President Trump has made it clear what he thinks of mail-in voting. On Tuesday, he tweeted, quote, mail-in voting, unless changed by the courts, will lead to the most corrupt election in our nation's history, end quote. As you said, you expanded mail-in voting for the recent primary runoff and for the November election. Why was that important to do?
Well, we need to make sure we understand there's a major difference between direct mail-in voting and absentee voting. The president is not opposed to absentee voting, and we only have absentee voting by mail in the state of Alabama. You can vote absentee in person or you can vote absentee by mail, but there are certain standards that have to be adhered to, and when those are, all the safety security mechanisms are in place.
And what are the safety mechanisms you have in place in Alabama?
Well, first of all, you have to make sure that you include a photocopy of your valid ID when you submit your application. Secondly, you have to make sure you follow all the standards related to your absentee ballot being counted, which means that you have to have completed the ballot accurately, you have to seal it correctly, you have to make sure that it is signed by two witnesses or by a notary. That's the law in Alabama, and those that want to participate will follow the law. And as I've already told you, in the runoff, a record-breaking 32,563 people did so. So we know that the people that want to do that will do it, and they will follow the law, period.
That's Alabama Secretary of State, Republican John Merrill. Secretary, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me as your guest.
And joining us now to continue this conversation is Andrea Young. She's the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia. Andrea, welcome to 1A.
Great. Welcome. Glad to be here.
And also still with us, ProPublica's Jessica Hoosman. Jessica, first, when we hear this question about voting by mail leading to voter fraud, as the president suggests, is there any evidence supporting that?
No, not really. I mean, voter fraud is kind of vanishingly rare across the board. It is slightly less rare when it comes to mail-in ballots, but that doesn't make it likely to happen. And it won't mean that our elections are tainted. And I think that a lot of the reason that in past years you have seen an increased amount of fraud with absentee ballots is because of the lack of security, because mail-in ballots weren't very popular in many states, and so there wasn't really a reason to need a massive regime of security underneath some of these ballot options. That's no longer true, and states have learned from the five states that are doing this by mail, and in those five states, vote by mail fraud is almost non-existent. And so, I think that it's a much different landscape, and Trump is basing his conclusions off of inflated numbers.
Well, Andrea, I want to hear from you. What are some of your biggest concerns when it comes to the November election?
Well, we have all the concerns that, some of your listeners have called in. We're concerned about whether or not the counties have enough workers and machines to process absentee ballots in a timely way. We are very concerned about the deadline that mail-in ballots have to be received by Election Day rather than postmarked, because this president has crippled the post office. And so we've had long, sometimes 10 days between when people requested absentee ballots and when they received them. We're concerned about people having enough options of how to deliver their ballots. So again, because of the, in Georgia, the ballots have to be received by Election Day. And so we're working through advocacy and litigation to address many of those needs.
Well, we've heard from a number of listeners who echo the same concern as Maura from Wisconsin.
My concern about November's election is that President Trump will find some way to illegally win the election, or if he does not win, will refuse to leave the White House.
In an interview with Fox News Sunday, Trump refused to say he would accept the results if he loses. Very quickly, Andrea, what do you think of Maura's concern?
Well, I think, you know, I think that we certainly are concerned about the president's attitude towards our democracy is certainly quite lacking in the things that he's expressed. But I think we do still see the resilience of our American system, and it just makes it that much more important that people overcome the hurdles that they may face to cast a ballot and to be engaged in this participatory process. I mean, we have seen,
Andrew, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We've got to go break. That's the executive director of the ACLU of Georgia, Andrea Young, and ProPublica's Jessica Hussman. We're discussing what the pandemic means for the November general election. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
Every business has to figure out what to charge for its product and how to keep out competitors. You know who does this better than anyone else? Drug dealers. On the next episode of Planet Money Summer School, we explain pricing theory with a drug kingpin. Summer School, new classes every Wednesday. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
We're talking about what the November election might look like, and we asked you for your thoughts. Here's what Herb from Indiana told us.
I'm wondering what we're going to do if we get to November and have a terrifically confused national election. We could have different states adopting different responses to the pandemic, some allowing absentee voting, some not. And I can imagine us getting to election eve with uncertainty about the outcome in many states and uncertainty about the overall outcome of the election. And of course, we could have an incumbent who might not accept the results of the election and refuse to leave. My question for your guest is, how do we get out of this mess? How do we have a campaign and an election that will result with enough faith in the American people that an outcome, whatever it is, will be accepted by the people and respected by the candidates?
Still with us, our ProPublica elections reporter, Jessica Hussman, and Andrea Young, the executive director of the ACLU of Georgia. Andrea, I think this is a good place to pick up your thought. Mm-hmm. You were talking about the resilience of our democracy, and Herb here has some real concerns.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we're saying to people in Georgia is get involved and step up, you know, be a part of election administration. We're recruiting and training poll workers right now that, you know, we lost a lot of poll workers because of legitimate concerns about coronavirus. The average age of a poll worker in Fulton County was 72. And so we're recruiting, you know, young lawyers, young people to get more civically engaged, to be a full participant in their community, in working at the polls and being a part of the solution. And I urge, you know, anyone who is concerned to do that, you know, to get involved, to make it work. Because, you know, Benjamin Franklin said, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. And so people have to be engaged and hands-on in the work of democracy. It's participatory.
Well, Phil emailed us with a thought very much in the same vein. He says, please discuss why there is not a huge, broad, well-publicized, coast-to-coast recruiting effort for younger and less COVID-risk poll workers. Of all the voting issues, this is one that can be addressed. Are we seeing this move in places outside of Georgia, Andrea?
Yes, the ACLU, and there's a coalition organization, All Voting is Local, that's doing this across the country. And I'm sure that this is going on. You know, and that is a nonpartisan effort. I believe also, you know, Democratic Party offices are doing this as well on the partisan side. But yes, it was a big wake-up call that we have. You know, we've really let our baby boomers take a lot of the burden of managing elections, and then we complain. And so, you know, the solution to that is let's get some young tech-savvy people, you know, that are involved, that are familiar with things like, you know, these electronic poll books, which people had a lot of problems with in Georgia in the primary. And, you know, I'm not the one that's going to troubleshoot the iPad for you. So... we need to really involve, and I think that also helps to deal with legitimacy, because the more people from the community that are involved in, you know, making elections happen, the more they can trust the system and the outcome, because it is very important that people have faith, you know, in the process, and I think we're probably having more discussion about what goes into creating a free and fair election than we've had in a very long time.
Well, Jessica, we're hearing from a lot of people who are concerned about mailing in their ballot. Pam emailed us. In general, I think the Kentucky primary was a mail-in ballot success story. However, I was very disappointed that the ballot I completed correctly and deposited in the regular mailbox outside the post office a week before Election Day was apparently lost in the mail and was not received by the county clerk's office. Unless the mail is more reliable, I will vote in person in November. And then we got this email from Poe, who says, I'm a New Jersey resident living in Chicago. I submitted my absentee ballot well before the close of the primary and just got my ballot returned to me with the stamp circled. I don't know what this means exactly. And he's concerned, you know, whether this is enough of a reason to suppress, as he says, suppress my right to vote. There are going to be people who make the decision to vote in person because they don't trust the mail system. How are localities adapting under these circumstances?
You know, I think that this goes back to what I said at the beginning, which is that these are the things that happen when counties switch to vote by mail without appropriate lead time. So one of the reasons that states can do vote by mail well in the five states and now six that are going to be doing this universally in November is because they've had time to work with their local USPS to standardize the processes. And so they identify ballots in specific ways with the USPS, and those, and the USPS and those regions treats ballots in very specific and standardized ways. And one of the reasons that that can happen is because the envelopes are, for example, standardized. But if you're a state like Kentucky, you probably did not have time to go out and source hundreds of thousands of secure envelopes that all look exactly the same and print them in the exact same way so that the USPS can recognize the thing that you're mailing as a ballot and not just some piece of mail that's going to the Board of Elections. And so I think that, you know, the lack of standardization around that process in states or even in large regions can make the delivery of mail pretty difficult to do during these times. So I think that it goes back to whether or not election administrators are thinking ahead to work with USPS to set up these standards and to make sure that questions can be answered easily. And I think the more time that states spend ramping up their system, the easier these problems will be to avoid. But I am also concerned that we'll see a lot of people who are either confused about the process because they weren't educated appropriately on how to interact with the USPS, or because the USPS simply isn't prepared to handle that level of mail influx around Election Day because they just didn't have enough time.
We're getting a lot of questions along this line from Sue, who wrote to us on Facebook. She says, I'm concerned that President Trump will not accept the election results. He will either sue and throw it to the Supreme Court, or will try to get state legislatures to vote for electors, which could be done. Jessica, your thoughts?
I think that both of those options are a little bit far-fetched, especially if the election is not close this year. And if the polls hold, it may not be. I mean, of course, anything can happen between now and November, and the polls are just a snapshot in time. But I think that depending on turnout and depending on the sort of difference in votes, it will be difficult for him to claim that the election is illegitimate. And I think that you only really have to look back at the primaries to see that states are going to handle this as best they can. I think that there were lots and lots of people who were predicting that Kentucky, for example, would be an outright disaster, and lots of fear mongering on the internet about long lines and manipulation of ballots, and none of that played out. I think that election administrators across the country are trying very hard to do what they can with the resources that they have, and I think that we'll be pleasantly surprised in November.
Well, to that point, Debbie emailed us saying, I was a ballot observer in Kenton County for our recent primary. The safeguards that are in place are very strong. I have full confidence in the integrity of voting by mail in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Andrea, we've been talking a lot about mail-in voting as an option, but there are concerns mm-hmm. with equity and accessibility there, too. Talk about that a bit more.
Well, you know, there are, we certainly have done, you know, some work with disability rights organizations and, of course, you know, low-income voters, which is one reason, you know, we have brought a lawsuit around the issue of postage. You know, it seems nominal if you are you know, a middle-class person that just, you know, keeps a books of stamps around. But, you know, we're in a time when people are in food lines to be able to feed their families. And so, you know, a couple of dollars in stamps, you know, people are having to decide between the franchise and eating. And one of the things we really focus on in our in the ACLU of Georgia is we want to look at voting from the most distressed, the most marginalized, the most at-risk voters, and make sure that we are enabling their access. And I want to just say congratulations for Debbie. That's exactly the point. The more people who are involved in our process, who are as monitors, as poll workers, as poll watchers, you know, as driving people to the polls, that level of engagement is transformative. And it is exactly, you know, what needs to happen for people who are really concerned that, you know, about our democracy, that they hands-on step up and be a part of the solution.
Well, Jessica, for many, Representative John Lewis was synonymous with the Voting Rights Act, and now there's a new push in the Senate to pass a renewed Voting Rights Act in his name. Can you tell us what's in that bill?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that it would ensure a lot of these protections that she's been talking about and would expand the level of funding, for example, that's available to election administrators. It's a lot of the same voting rights stuff that Democrats have been talking about for a long time. And I think that the bill is thoughtful and well considered. I don't know that there is much chance, unfortunately, of success, at least this year.
As we wrap up here, Jessica, quickly, what will you be watching between now and November?
You know what? This is such a nerdy answer, but I will be watching the supply chain. Mm. I would really love to know if the United States actually possesses the amount of privacy envelopes that will be necessary to pull off November.
And what about you, Andrea? Big push between now and November.
We are pushing to make sure that every single person in Georgia who is eligible to vote and wants to vote is able to cast an informed ballot.
That's Andrea Young, the executive director of the ACLU of Georgia, and ProPublica's elections reporter, Jessica Huseman. Thanks to you both. And remember,
Thank
we
you.
Have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. This conversation was produced by Amanda Williams, with thanks to our Across America partner, WBHM, in Birmingham, Alabama. Our podcast is edited by Matthew Simonson. Foundation. 1A Across America is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.